The title of this morning's session is called The Existential Conditions for Knowledge. I guess some people don't know what's meant by existential conditions. It means the way you have to live or be in order to have knowledge. First, I wanted to talk about knowledge. And I've been describing Krishna consciousness as a process of knowledge, and not just knowledge, but scientific knowledge, not just jnanam, but vijnanam, or realized knowledge. So I wanted to describe that a little bit, what we mean by that. The word is used. The sources of knowledge are usually given as three, at least for us. Sense perception, which is pratyaksha. The word pratyaksha means aksha is eyes, or eye, and prati is in front of. So that which is immediate present to the senses is called pratyaksha. Anumana, which is inference. And shabda, which is scriptural authority. And ultimately, of course, Jiva Goswami says is that you can't trust pratyaksha because Prabhupada says we have four, every conditioned soul has four defects, including senses that are limited and defective, and so on. So really our knowledge is based on shabda, scripture, and reasoning, sound reasoning that's based on scripture. Other than that, logic and argument based on scripture, other than that. But the word pratyaksha shows up in another sense in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 9th chapter. Krishna says, it's called the most confidential knowledge. And he says, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge. And he says, not jnanam vijnanam sahitam, jnanam along with vijnanam. And he says, this knowledge, he says, rajavidya rajaguyam vitram idam uttamam pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam. Pratyaksha, it gives direct perception, direct experience. Prabhupada translates it, a direct perception of the self by realization. So there's another kind of pratyaksha, or direct perception, and this is also what is meant by vijnanam. Prabhupada calls realized knowledge. Then Jiva Goswami talks about what he calls Vaidusha Pratyaksha. Vaidusha means, refers to those who are wise, or those who are advanced. So Vaidusha Pratyaksha, the direct perception of spiritually advanced people. He said that Pratyaksha is the source of Shabda. That's where scripture comes from. For example, we have the Brahma Samhita, and that is the direct perception of Lord Brahma. He sees, and then he reports, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu Kalpaviksha Lakshavateshu, and so on. He's just giving an inventory of his experience. The Bhagavad Gita is what is perceived by Vyasadeva, and so on. So you look and you see that the Shastra relates the direct perception of certain people. That is to say, people who are qualified to see God or to see the absolute truth. So what is this seeing? This kind of pratyaksha, or this, when we talk about realized knowledge, We want to see what is it and what are the conditions. The other thing about this knowledge, also in the seventh chapter, which is also called Knowledge of the Absolute, Krishna says, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in full, free from doubt, asamshayam, samagraham. You can know me completely, thoroughly, and without any doubt. And in the purport, Prabhupada quotes the sequence of verses beginning Shinvatam Sukata Krishna, which describes the process of Krishna consciousness, and that ends with saying that Vidyate Hridaya Grantis, the knot in the heart is pierced, that knot in the heart is Ahankara, that unites the living entity to the material conception, that knot is pierced. Kidyante sarva samshaya, and all samshaya, doubts or misgivings, are cut to pieces. And shiyante chasya karmani, and the chain of karmic reaction is terminated when one finally has this direct perception of the self by realization, the super soul by realization. So there's a question of what is this knowledge that is free from all doubts, because you can say, well, I want to see it for myself, and there's pratyaksha, you know, in the material world, but actually, of course, sense perception has been, by a long tradition of philosophers, have understood that sense perception is quite unreliable, and doesn't give, even the kind of work that Thomas Kuhn does shows that you may have sense perception and so on, but the sense perception you have is conditioned by your predilections, your desires, your interests, your lack of interest, and so on. And so on a certain level, you can say it just shows the relativity of all so-called knowledge. And so sense perception is regarded as not very certain. So what is it to have sure and certain knowledge? Of course, this has been the search of philosophers. The famous one is Descartes' famous decided he was going to doubt everything that was possibly doubtable, and decided, you know, I see this world around me, but how do I know there's not an evil demon who's projecting this whole thing on a screen just to deceive me, and so that I'm actually, the whole world is an hallucination put forward by a diabolical being, a sort of a Gnostic sort of a thing, actually. People used to think like that. But how do I know I'm not deceived? And of course, finally what Descartes did was decide that, well, he could doubt, but he couldn't doubt his own doubting. There was a doubter, and that was indubitable. So that his own consciousness, I mean, his favorite credo, ego sum, I think, therefore I am, which really means I'm conscious, I'm aware, and therefore I am. And there was something about things being as immediate as his own existence as a conscious being, which he couldn't doubt. So there he found the one secure place. Then from there he goes to God via the ontological argument. And then, of course, there it all falls apart in some people's mind. He even uses a bad form of the argument. There's a form of the ontological argument. I mean, it's an argument considering the nature of existence. And this argument in its strongest form says that if you think that if you understand what God is, you know that God exists without the possibility of not existing. In other words, if you think, like this pair of sunglasses, it might exist or might not exist, this cup might exist or might not exist, because these are contingent entities in this world. If you think God is something that just might exist or might not exist, you're not thinking about God, you're thinking about a contingent entity. So if you actually understand what we mean by God, we mean a being who exists so truly that he exists without the possibility of even not existing. Therefore, it exists. See? So that's a nifty little sort of argument, because to think that God might not exist is involved in a self-contradiction. But it's controversial. The ontological argument has raised a great deal of controversy, and for preaching purposes, it's useless. You'll get yourself embroiled in controversy. Although there's something about it that's very attractive, I think. But anyway, people have been searching for some kind of, this indubitable knowledge. And what we're talking about here is a kind of direct perception, but is not the perception of material senses. Now, some people say, well, this is mystic knowledge. And actually, they use the word intuition. But usually nowadays, when we hear intuition, we think of a sort of a guess. We don't think of something that has any and has certainty to it. So, mystic intuition or mystic vision or stuff like that. People don't put it under the name of knowledge, really. Anyway, I want to talk about this. This process of knowledge is described in the Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter. But first of all, we are urged to engage in tattva jignasa, inquiry toward the absolute truth. Tattva. You know this word tattva? It's all over the place. Tat means that, and twa means is the equivalent of the English NESS. So it means fatness, tattva. But it's used to indicate any kind of fundamental principle, or it's also used to mean the absolute truth. It's called tattva, like tattvavadis. The school of Madhvacharya called tattvavadis, people who speak about the truth, know the truth. So this is about... It says in the text 10, life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. But here we go, this is the day and night, the direction of the intelligence. So here it's pointing us in the right way. Huh? Life's desire should never be directed towards sense gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation. In other words, this sets the limits. How much sense gratification can one have? Enough to stay alive. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the absolute truth, tattva jignasa. Nothing else should be the goal of one's work. Then the next verse describes this tattva. Vedanti tattva vidas. They say, those who are tattva vida, those who know the tattva, who know this tattva, tattva jnanam advayam, and this tattva is described as jnanam advayam. I should write that. Trouble is, once I go over to write on the board, then I lose the microphone. You want to do that? Jnanam advayam. It means non-dual knowledge. It is non-dual knowledge. Jnanam advayam. A-D-V-A-Y-A-M. Advayam. Jnanam advayam. It's two words, it's not hyphenated here. Jnanam advayam. A-D-V-A advayam. Without duality. Because jnanam advayam is, even though it's jnanam advayam, non-dual knowledge, it is known in three names, Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. Encountered, those who know the Absolute have encountered this jnanam advayam as Brahman, as Paramatman, and as Bhagavan. Now what is meant by jnanam advayam? Prabhupada says in the first sentence, the Absolute Truth is both subject and object. In other words, we are the subject, and the absolute truth is the object. You can look at it that way. I'm the subject, the knowing subject, and that's the object. But that absolute truth is also a subject. And at the same time, as a subject, I'm part and parcel of the object. Now, Jnanam Advayam is interpreted by the Mayavadis as saying the subject-object distinction vanishes. They say that when you reach absolute knowledge, the knower, the thing known, and the act of knowing coalesce into a single unity. In other words, you become that entity. Well, of course, to my mind, then, you know, why call it knowledge? It's not. I mean, knowledge means there's a knower, and there's that which is known, and there's the act of knowing. It's a transaction. It's a relational term, knowledge. And they want to say there's a state in which there is no relational terms whatsoever. So, it's not, I don't know why you call it knowledge anyway, but that's what they say. Because taking this word non-duality to its furthest extreme. Anyway, I'll explain how Prabhupada says. He says, the supreme truth is self-sufficient, cognizant, and free from the illusion of relativity. In the relative world, the knower is different from the known. Sounds just like a Mayavadi so far, huh? The knower is different from the known. But in the absolute truth, both the knower and the known are one and the same thing. In the relative world, the knower is the living spirit or spiritual energy, whereas the known is inert matter or inferior energy. Therefore, there is a duality of inferior and superior energy, whereas in the absolute realm, both the knower and the known are of the same superior energy. So that's what he says. In other words, there remains in this Vaidusha, in this Pratyaksha we're talking about. See, our Pratyaksha here, the conscious entity, is a spirit. What I know is whatever is perceptible to my material senses is made of inferior energy. It's unconscious. I'm one thing, and these are what I know are all structures of matter. Anything other than structures of matter, I have to infer the existence of. Even the subtle structures of matter. You know, like there's a school of philosophers who want to say that when we talk about people having minds, we're not referring to some occult processes going on, but really their behavior. So one philosopher says, feelings? There are no feelings. Dispositions, perhaps, but no feelings. In other words, feelings means a tendency to behave in a certain way. That's what a feeling is. So these are some things that people want to be rigorous about. So what to speak of the soul? We don't directly perceive the soul. The soul, we're saying the soul is there. We're conscious of our own consciousness. But your consciousness, I could, it's very hard if somebody decides he's going to be a solipsist and say, I'm the only existing thing and all of you are projections of my imagination. It's a very hard position to refute, except by killing him, I suppose. But then he's not there to see the proof, huh? That you're still going on while he's dead. But other people's consciousness. So in the material world, it's sort of like you're on a highway during a rainstorm, and all the cars are going. And you know there's drivers in the cars, but basically all you see are these big lumbering cars, and the windshields are all fogged up, and you're just seeing the cars going back and forth. You don't see each other. So we don't see each other. We see, what we see is the material body. And in fact, I usually know your mentality through through your speech, through your body language, through your expressions on your face, and I kind of have to guess at your mentality, because it only expresses itself, it's only visible to me. We don't usually directly read minds. It's beyond most of our capacity. So the knower is one thing, the spirit and the thing known is something else. But what Prabhupada means to say by Advaya again is now the knower is spirit, and what he knows, the absolute truth, is also spirit. So that knowledge has a, and not only that, but I might add, we are called Atman, but the Lord is also called Atman. We're the self, but he is the self of all selves. So it would be reasonable to suggest that knowing Krishna has something of the characteristic of knowing ourselves. Just like Descartes knew himself and knew his own existence with a surety that could not be denied. Similarly, when Krishna is known, it has a similar sort of assurance to it. It's Advaya again, non-dual knowledge. Therefore, he says, asamshaya, without any doubt. It said that in every act of knowledge, Prabhupada says in one place in the second canto, he says, we don't see without Krishna seeing first. We don't hear anything without Krishna's hearing first. So actually, if we know what Krishna is, we also know that Krishna is part of the content of every experience that we have. We cannot experience anything without also experiencing Krishna. But we don't see Krishna because we don't know how to see him. And the process of Krishna consciousness, is... Krishna comes out of the background and more into the foreground so that Krishna is directly perceived. In every act of knowing or seeing anything, ultimately Krishna is also known and perceived. Prabhupada also talks about the vision of a devotee, that a pure devotee has broadcast in his heart, as if by a kind of television, Krishna's leela as they are going on in Goloka Vrindavan. And he can see and actually participate in that leela, even if he's here in this material world. At the same time, the devotee sees outside, Krishna is outside, he's in the core of every atom, as the supersoul. And he realizes this is one and the same Krishna, inside and outside. So these are some of the attributes of this Vaidushya Pratyaksha, or this vision of Krishna consciousness, and it is not some tentative or hesitant or weak form of knowledge. It is actual perception. It's not cloudy or vague. When people talk about this in terms of Mayavad philosophy, then of course it becomes very, I have an experience. And that experience is one in which the knower, the thing known, and the act of knowledge becomes one. Then I come back down here. What can I tell you about it? I can't say a thing. I'm speechless. And I say, well, you know, I had this experience, but it wasn't really experience because there wasn't any me experiencing it, and so on. And you can't say much about it. But in this knowledge is described in the Bhagavatam. There remains ourselves, there remains Krishna, and there remains a relationship of knowing, but it's of a different character or quality of the knowledge that takes place here in the material world. And the goal of our process is actually to see Krishna. This is described in a number of places, and the words are used it goes on. Next verse, after describing the absolute truth, the seriously inquisitive student or sage, well equipped with knowledge and detachment, realizes that absolute truth by rendering devotional service in terms of what he has heard from the Vedanta Sutri, Shruti. So he has described two things. One is the existential conditions for knowledge, jnana vairagya, equipped with not only jnana, that is to say a theoretical framework, but vairagya, renunciation or detachment. These, you always see this compound, jnana vairagya. So these two things are there. And then what Prabhupada translates as realizes is pasyanti. They see. Atmani chatmani. They see in the self or by the within himself the atma, the super self. Although it's the same word. But the word here is pasyanti. They see. So again, the reference is there. By means of devotional service and what he has heard from the Shruta Brihita, the Vedic literature. So we're supposed to in Krishna consciousness be on a process for developing this kind of knowledge. So we have to see what do we have to do or how do we have to behave in order to foster this knowledge. Because when you talk about knowledge like this to people who are trained in modern empirical tradition, they don't want to credit it as knowledge. But here we're talking because the fact is they have no access to it. We say here is a discipline, and by this discipline you could acquire knowledge. And they want to say, that's a religion. I won't buy it for a minute. It's a tradition of knowledge, and a tradition of knowledge which they have no access to because they simply don't want to take the steps in order to enter into the process. But we can say, you can see, this is what I see, you know, and they say, I don't want to look. What can you do? It's like the cardinal who's supposed to refuse to look through Galileo's telescope because he didn't want to see, you know, Aristotelian metaphysics completely be refuted at a glance. So he just wouldn't look. So if people don't want to look, you can't show them. But now we have to understand certain of the conditions by which this knowledge develops, and that is described. As I said, in the paradigm that we're given, we are given this paradigm, sattva, rajas, and tamas, the three modes of material nature. Again, you have that sattva, translated as goodness, N-E-S-S, pwasness, and sat means good, being, existence, reality, all kinds of things, sattva. And we said earlier that we see that material nature is being created, maintained, and destroyed. When it's being maintained, it's in the sattva condition. When things are being created, it's in the rajas condition. And then when there's destruction, decay, disintegration, it's tamas, darkness or ignorance. So these also are developed, are present to human beings who become conditioned by these modes. And we've been given a kind of clinical description of those things in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the three modes of material nature, which Krishna describes, and he says to Arjuna, by becoming fixed in this knowledge, one can attain to the transcendental nature like my own. Thus established, one is not born at the time of creation or disturbed at the time of disillusion. That's an interesting thing about this three modes of material nature. Prabhupada said, just by understanding it through philosophical speculation, he can come to the transcendental stage. If one understands this chapter through the process of philosophical speculation, he will come to an understanding of devotional service. That's what Prabhupada says, exactly. Come to an understanding of devotional service. Then if you follow up on it by doing it, then. So, What we find out is, of course, is that he describes it. Mode of goodness is pure and is illuminating, frees one from sinful reaction. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. Mode of passion is born of unlimited desires and longings. And because of this, the embodied living entity is bound to material fruit of actions. And tamagun, the result of this mode, madness, indolence, sleep, which binds the conditioned soul. And so on. I think most of us are. The mode of goodness conditions one to happiness, passion conditions one to fruit of action, and ignorance binds one to madness. What we see in human beings are three types. Goodness, the consciousness is different. The archetypical, the central act, or central activity, the mode of passion is sexual reproduction, because that growth and increase and development all comes under that. And from that, from attachment to sexual activity comes the whole material advancement of civilization, as Prabhupada describes it. This is the mode of passion. Most of what we see of any time when there's economic development, especially a hypertrophy of economic development, a super development, overdevelopment of activities of getting and spending and trafficking and back and forth, this is excess of mode of passion. Mode of ignorance, laziness, indolence, sleep, things fall apart. People lie on the couch, they watch television, they take drugs, they can't even get up to turn the TV off, it stays on all night long, goes on all day. This is, in the mode of ignorance, there's just, and the result of the mode of ignorance is insanity. The result of mode of passion is misery. Misery because one has unlimited desires and hankerings, and they are never satisfied. So at the end of life, you've done so much, you've been so busy, you've worn yourself out, getting and getting and getting, and still you're not satisfied. That's the archetypical mode of passion. And in the process, you've created so many problems for yourself and other people. So you're miserable and unsatisfied. In the mode of ignorance, the result is actually insanity. Which, by the way, is, of course, increasing all over the world, it would seem. And mode of goodness, one becomes happy. Prabhupada uses this phrase, I have taken hippies and turned them into happies. Meaning he had taken people who are mostly in the mode of ignorance. You see his description of hippies. They lie around in the streets, they don't bathe, they have no employment. He saw people in the mode of ignorance. We saw, you know, different things, but he saw the mode of ignorance. In fact, the generation gap of the 60s was the mode of passion versus the mode of ignorance. The parents are saying, why don't you get a job? Why don't you do this? You know, they're saying, why bother? You know, you have everything just laying around. Anyway, that was it. That was it. So, the three modes of nature work like that. And I said you can learn to see that way. Is here the categories, you read the descriptions, and you start to look, and you start to see, here's the manifestation of goodness, here's the manifestation of passion, here's the manifestation of ignorance. And sometimes they're mixed together in different sorts of ways. Now, what happens in Krishna consciousness, what we have to learn about, and what I mean about the existential conditions of knowledge, is that knowledge depends upon goodness. Prabhupada says, somewhere in this chapter, he said, today the standard of advancement of civilization is in the mode of passion. Formerly, the standard of advancement of civilization was in the mode of goodness. So what constitutes goals of life and what you should become and what considers to be better and better, that depends upon the modes of nature. So the standard in the mode of advancement is getting and spending, trafficking back and forth, more and more of skyscrapers, more and more steel, more and more concrete, more and more. That's the standard of the mode of passion. In the mode of passion, there is not the development of what we call knowledge. Now, mode of passion has a certain kind of knowledge. That is, how to do something before you're acquiring your sense gratifications. The mode of passion fosters a lot of technical skill or technical ability. But for actual knowledge of the absolute truth, it disappears from view. It's not accessible from the mode of passion. What to speak of the mode of ignorance? The mode of ignorance, you don't even care. Anyway, there's three different kinds of consciousness. In the mode of passion, consciousness is excited, but very narrowly directed. A person in the mode of passion is kind of alert, but that alertness is very selective, because he's got some desire, object of desire, on which the person is fixated, and that's and around that, everything else gets organized. A person in the mode of ignorance is just oblivious, doesn't know what's happening, doesn't pick up on anything. The mode of goodness, the consciousness of mode of goodness, is detached, it's alert, very aware, but calm. Very calm and peaceful and serene, but not like the mode of ignorance, where that serenity is just sleep, basically, or you know, drugged down consciousness. But the consciousness in the mode of goodness is very calm, very serene, but extremely alert and kind of inquisitive and wanting to find out what's going on, but without any particular aim in view, except just the being alert and inquisitive. The person in the mode of passion, as soon as his attention is the object of desire disappears, or there isn't an object of desire, suddenly it's like the puppet strings have been cut. They don't know what to do, and they have to find something else to get going. So as soon as I make my first $1 million, nothing has to happen, but I have to have the second million. As soon as I get this, then I have to go to this. And as soon as I possess one thing, I have to go on to the next thing. Otherwise, there's no driving force. So anyway, this statement of Prabhupada that formerly the standard of advancement was in the mode of goodness is very revelatory situation. Now, in devotional service, it's clear from the Bhagavatam that if we want to actually develop and progress along this path of knowledge, we have to become preliminarily situated in the mode of goodness. You can start from any mode and engage yourself in Krishna service, but the mode of goodness should gradually develop. And Prabhupada describes this in the second, when these verses are describing the process of devotional service, when it says all that is inauspicious in the heart disappears, and devotional service becomes established as an irrevocable fact. The next verse says what it is that disappears. Tada raja tama bhava, the mode of ignorance and the mode of passion, which are described as kama, lust and desire, lobha, hankering, adayaha, and so on. All of these things go away. And stitam satte prasidati, one becomes situated in the mode of goodness. Well, then, you have to go further, because ultimately devotional service is called Vishuddha Sattva. The platform is called Vasudev, with a long A, or Vishuddha Sattva. You see, it's like this. If Lord Vishnu is the Guna avatar in charge of Sattva Guna, just like Brahma's in charge of creation, and Shiva's in charge of destruction. So it is Vishnu who takes charge of the material mode of goodness, because in the spiritual realm, it is pure goodness. There is no coming into being or going out of being. So it's sattva without any tinge whatsoever of raja and tamas. So therefore it's called Shuddha Sattva or Vishuddha Sattva, purified goodness. So when one is transcendental, has transcended the modes altogether, which is the state one is aspiring to, Sagunan Samitichaitan Brahmabhuyaya Kalpate. He transcends, Sagunan Samitichi transcends the gunas, and Brahmabhuyaya Kalpate comes to the platform of Brahman. That Brahman is beyond the modes of material nature. So that even the mode of goodness has to be transcended. But first of all, to get up there, there has to be a launching pad, so to speak. That's a passionate activity, shooting rockets off, so I don't want to mislead anybody, but there has to be a platform, a material platform, and that platform is in the mode of goodness. And Prabhupada says this explicitly. The soul's activity becomes adulterated in contact with matter, and as such the diseased activities are expressed in the form of lust, desire, hankering, inactivity, foolishness, and sleep. The effect of devotional service becomes manifest by complete elimination of these effects of passion and ignorance. The devotee is fixed at once in the mode of goodness. So he says there's the sattva guna, in the mode of goodness. And he makes further progress to rise to the position of Vasudeva, or the state of unmixed sattva or shuddha sattva. Only in this Shuddha Sattva state can one always see Krishna eye to eye. So these are the bold statements probably. Always see Krishna eye to eye by dint of pure affection for the Lord. Again, in the next purport, he says, as soon as one understands that he has nothing to do with matter, he at once ceases his material hankerings and becomes enlivened as a spiritual being. This attainment of success is possible when one is above the modes of passion and ignorance, or, in other words, when one is actually a brahmana by qualification. A brahmana is the symbol of sattva guna, or the mode of goodness. Others who are not in the mode of goodness are either kshatriyas, vaishyas, shudras, or less than the shudras. The brahminical stage is the highest stage of human life because of its good qualities. So one cannot be a devotee unless one at least qualifies as a brahmana. The devotee is already a brahmana by action, but that is not the end of it, and then you have to go on and go beyond the brahmana stage and become a vaishnava. That's what he says. So at least a qualified as a brahmana. Again, here, just to understand about the modes of nature and how the mode of goodness is necessary, this is Canto 3, Chapter 26, the purport to Text 31. We can actually see, therefore, that those who are very passionate can improve in material acquisitions very quickly. This is the material advancement of society. It is recommended in the Vedic scriptures. I wish I had a reference for this one. This is a good one. It is recommended in the Vedic scriptures that if one wants to encourage a person in acquiring material possessions, one should also encourage him in sex life. We naturally find that those who are addicted to sex, you want to know what the, you know, you don't have to know the Vedic scriptures to see how they sell automobiles and so on, you know. We naturally find that those who are addicted to sex life are also materially advanced, because sex life or passionate life is the impetus for the material advancement of civilization. For those who want to make spiritual advancement, there is almost no existence of the mode of passion. Only the mode of goodness is prominent. And then he goes on to say, that's why you see people engaged in Krishna consciousness are poor. So folks, it's authorized. We have to watch out when we become rich, right? And then later on, there's a verse I quoted, a sentence I quoted yesterday. Persons infatuated by material consciousness are very intelligent in discovering things for material comforts, but they have no access to understanding the spiritual, spirit soul, and spiritual life. So this explains, I think, why there's a difference. And sometimes we just have to accept that there's going to be a difference. I remember when Prabhupada was in an airport in New York, and the reporter said, "Why do you dress differently?" And Prabhupada said, "We are different." He said, "We are spiritual and you are material." That's what he said, it with a smile, you know. It wasn't being insulting or anything like that. But we are different. And the difference is that we have a different standard of advancement. We have a different goal in life. And our lives are coherently organized about this particular goal. Hmm. Yeah, you want to... Only the fundraisers will have money. They're in the mode of passion. We see the fundraisers, first of all, they raise funds to support their fundraising, and then if there's anything left over, they distribute to everybody else. This is one of the laws of fundraising. Now, of course, we want to have funds for spreading Krishna consciousness. If we want to preach Krishna consciousness, it requires money. But devotees have to remain poor, even though they may have access to so much money. We can't be tempted into becoming the enjoyer of what are Krishna's assets. So I think that Krishna will not, if you really want to know fundraising, if you really want to get money for using Krishna's service, Krishna has to be convinced we're not going to expropriate it for other purposes. And he may not be convinced yet. Therefore, I want to recommend the mode of goodness. This is definitely what Prabhupada says. Of course, we say, well, what about kshatriyas, and we're talking about varnashram dharma and so on. And that can only be something that is preliminary to the condition of coming to the mode of goodness. Ultimately, I can be engaged in Krishna's service no matter what mode of nature I am in. But by being engaged in Krishna's service, then kama, lobha, all these things have to subside. And we have to become established in the mode of goodness. Now, this is not what is understood. This is our process of knowledge. It is not understood in the materialistic institutions of knowledge. You will not find them tell any student who engages in a philosophy course and wants the pursuit of knowledge, never mind the business schools and everything. Let's just talk about that. But now, your preliminary requirements, prerequisites for taking this course is no illicit sex, no intoxicants, and so on. They don't say that. People will sit strive for finding knowledge in so many different ways, but these basic requirements are not there. Now, they look back in their own tradition, you could see that, yeah, Plato said it. Right, he did. It's all there in Plato. But somehow or other, they don't accept him as a guru. They accept him as somebody else to criticize, I suppose. But if Plato said it, and so what happens is now is the existential conditions for developing genuine knowledge are simply not fostered, and they're not present. In fact, what it is people are engaged in activities that make it impossible to see God or even to see yourself. This is what happens. They become it turns to be a kind of a circle. I propound a philosophy that there is nothing but matter and I am matter. On the basis of that philosophy, well, what is the purpose of life in that case? Well, have a good time as you can. You know, there's a void before us and there's a void after us, and what we got now is this kind of spasm in the void, and let's make it the biggest and best spasm we can get. You know? So you live your life for spasms, and those kinds of experiences make it impossible for you to actually have the kind of experiences we're talking about. So the more people engage in the activities of sense gratification, the less they're able to have actual knowledge. It's a fact. So the Prabhupada was very clear. You know, there's two things. There's self-realization and there's sense gratification. And they don't go together. They're inversely proportional. When self-realization goes up, sense gratification goes down. And when sense gratification goes up, self-realization goes down. You know, there's no higher synthesis. It's like he describes it as day and night. And when there's light, there's no darkness, and when the darkness, there's no light. And that's the situation. So we have to recognize that this is the case, and we have to engage ourselves in the process of knowledge. It's explained exactly. We have exact information of why, what's wrong with sense gratification, because the sense gratification causes false ego. Because we notice that I can say to myself, I accept this, you know, doctrine, that I am not this body. But that doesn't get me off of the bodily platform. To actually realize myself as a spiritual being, I have to start following regulative principles and so on. Why is that? Because every time I engage in an act of sense gratification, and I guess we should give a little, I don't know, phenomenological analysis of what sense gratification is. What do we mean? Well, the senses come into contact with the sense objects, and a feeling of pleasure arises. Now, that in itself is not yet sense gratification. Because a devotee can have the same attitude toward pleasure as he does toward pain. And in Bhagavad Gita constantly said this, one who is not elated when they're happy when there is pleasure or downcast when there is pain. So just like sometimes the senses come into contact with the object and it feels bad, sometimes it comes into contact with the object and it feels good. But the sense gratification comes about is when it feels good, then my consciousness goes out and kind of wraps around it. I can only explain this metaphorically. And I take possession of this feeling, and I think, I am enjoying. I am the enjoyer. And every time we do that, whether little things or big things, we cause or increase the false ego. Every time I do that, my identification of the self with the material body increases. That's the problem with it. And so I can say to myself all I want, I am not this body, but if I'm bringing my senses into contact with sense objects and I'm taking possession of them as the enjoyer, and relishing them and wanting more and so on, becoming addicted to those things, I'll never have any realization whatsoever. So that's the problem with sense gratification. Then, because I identify myself with the material body, then I suffer. That's why Krishna says, "Yehi samsparsa jabhoga dukkha yonayevate." All these pleasures that arise between the contact of the senses and the objects, they in fact cause all your suffering. Therefore, those who are wise, they take no delight in them. That's why they cause suffering. So people don't know anymore. Nowadays, we're advanced in the mode of passion, and the accumulation of these pleasures is supposed to bring happiness. And we see that in the past, there's traditional religions and moralities which advocated regulation and restriction of sense pleasure. Nobody can figure out why. There must have been those nasty old life-denying patriarchs who didn't want anybody to have any fun and promulgated these thou shalt nots all over the place. Because in many of the traditional religions now, the thou shalt nots has survived, but nobody survived among people who have also lost the impetus for spiritual advancement. So the restrictions are now seem purposeless or meaningless, except to avoid, you know, getting hit by lightning. by an angry God. He says these things are bad, and if I do them, I'm going to get smashed. The real reason is that it's there for progressive life. But if the progressive life has fallen out and the restrictions remain, then people say, what's it for? So what Prabhupada did was at least bring back to many of us who had lost it the idea that there's genuine knowledge available through spiritual progress. But he said, this is what you have to do in order to get it. You have to put yourself in the correct situation so that this knowledge will develop. Otherwise, we can sit there, like many professors I know in religion departments, completely engaged in activities in the mode of passion and ignorance, and try to speculate about what's going on. They read all these texts, which are the testimony of the spiritual experiences of advanced people in the past, whatever tradition, and they try to figure out what's happening. And they put forward theories about, anyway, that's what they try to do. But the actual experiences for them are inaccessible, because they don't think that in order to see what's happening, I have to undergo. So they have a different way of understanding. But we want to understand those things. It's there to invite us to actually come to the position of direct perception of the truth. So anyway, we have to be, if we want to be successful, then we have to act in such a way that the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance diminish. That's why Prabhupada gave four regular principles, which are not the qualifications of super advanced devotees. It's the qualification of anyone who wants to become at least established in the mode of goodness. And Prabhupada calls them, it's such an interesting phrase, and it sounds so contradictory to people, he calls them the regulative principles of freedom. Where we think that freedom is the absence of regulative principles, he calls them the regulative principles of freedom. Because it brings freedom from control of the modes of material nature, and freedom from birth and death in the material world. So there have to be these kinds of regulations and restrictions, and if we want to be on this path, we have to, each of us, situate ourselves in such a way that we can follow those principles. We have to be careful, because the modes are infectious. We want to stay in the mode of goodness. It's best to associate with people who are assimilating in the mode of goodness. If we start associating with passionate people, ignorant people for prolonged periods of time, there's very good chance that we'll get caught. Unless we're really strong enough that those people can be turned to the mode of ignorance. I mean, turned from the mode of ignorance to the mode of goodness or something. Sometimes that can happen. We have to know our own strength and our own weakness and judge appropriately. Yanavi?
How are you taking?
Yeah, I'll take questions. Now, that's basically what I want to say, so go ahead. Now, I think you should come to the microphone, and because posterity wants to hear this.
So the first question to our very enlightened speaker here is to do with a further elaboration of this process of sense gratification that you were describing. The senses coming in contact with the objects of the senses. And my question is very specific to prasadam, Krishna prasadam. When you see that there's sometimes very elaborate arrangements made to prepare nice prasadam for devotees, sometimes go the whole nine yards. And on the other hand, sometimes devotees are making arrangements to prepare very simple prasadam for themselves. They'll go out of the way to avoid even the normal course. You know, the boiled vegetables and the khichdi and nothing else. And so where does sense gratification fit into this whole experience of honoring Krishna prasadam? And how can one avoid getting into the mode of sense gratification here?
Well, pizza, for example. I'm convinced that Krishna likes pizza. And that there's something new in Goloka Vrindavan. On pizza?
Yeah.
Really? I didn't remember that one. I must have been asleep. What did we decide?
You had too much pizza.
There's pizza. Because prasadam has been offered to Krishna, anyone who eats it becomes purified. So there's different ways of honoring prasadam. So first of all, of course, we have to have the right attitude. And that's the attitude of, we say we honor prasadam. Now, you know, on our bad days, we can just eat it. But down, people eat in the mode of goodness, passion, or ignorance, too. I once had a job delivering office supplies during the summer, and I had a boss who was a real moodha, you know. And when it was lunchtime, every day he'd look at his watch, and it was 12 o'clock, he'd stop and he'd say, "Well, time to put on the old feed bag." Feed bag is when, you know, what a horse wears over his mouth. So that's mode of ignorance. Oats are okay. Muesli. So what has to happen is that there's different ways of honoring prasad. So we tell people to sit down, eat more, eat all you can. And as we become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, we're supposed to start honoring prasad in a different consciousness. And that consciousness has to be ultimately that I'm eating Krishna's table scraps. And I'm thinking of Krishna when I'm doing it, as honoring. And very advanced is, you know, it's true, I eat whatever is put in front of me. I don't recognize if there's good or bad. It says that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, that if something was badly cooked, there was too much salt or something like that, they wouldn't say anything for a whole week. Then it would be brought up delicately. But it would... So that's another state of consciousness. And of course we have, who was it, Raghunath Das, who used to take the discarded prasadam that was, it would be leftover prasadam that had gone bad and was thrown away, and then the animals would go through it. When they didn't eat, he would wash it first. Actually, of course, rice goes spoiled and it's actually poisonous. So he would wash it so the soft, spoiled parts of the rice would be gone and there'd be only the little hard kernel. And that he would honor. And with full symptoms of transcendental ecstasy. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you know, when he found out about this, finally said, "You're having a feast and you're not inviting me." And it was a feast. It was a feast. So, according to your realizations, we started off the movement when I joined on a higher level of realization. And after the Sunday feast, since prasadam all could never be thrown away, it all had to be honored. The leftovers on everybody's plates at the Sunday feast guests were gathered together and put in one big plate. We called it merge. And you paid for the Sunday feast on Monday morning, because until the merge was all gone, they wouldn't serve out anything else. And we were told, this is prasadam, it's transcendental, you have to honor it. These were also the days when somebody at the Sunday feast would spill milk on the floor and somebody would get down and go, and everybody's looking. So in some ways we were more advanced. Anyway, we used to eat the merge and we were told, you know, it's prasadam, it can't get contaminated, even though it's unbinded. So I used to do it. And then one day I had some merge in my mouth and there was something weird in there and I spit it out and it was somebody's bubble gum. And I started gagging. And that was it, you know, I I couldn't. That broke my face. Because that bubble gum was not merge, you know. Something else it got. It wasn't transcendental. And then somebody wrote Prabhupada about it somewhere, and we got a letter saying that you know, you can honor it according to your faith. And so immediately everybody stopped. But if you see with Raghunath Das, it's a very high level of realization. But prasadam definitely seen, because Krishna consciousness begins with the tongue. And so some of the things that we do are fun. One of them is honoring prasadam. One of them is chanting the holy name in kirtan. That's also a lot of fun. And but if you're alert, you can tell when I'm gratifying my senses, and when I'm trying to satisfy Krishna. Now prasadam, when I overeat, I know what I'm doing. You know, I've had enough to satisfy myself. And I should stop. Anyway, that's what we used to say. You know, we take honor prasad and we say the senses are dragging me back to Godhead. It sort of has that character. It's more important, actually, that prasadam be prepared nicely, that is, in a devotional mood, and that it is a principle that we're not supposed to offer Krishna things just so we can have nice things to eat. This is really hard in house. You know, if you have your own household and you have your kids, boy, it's really tough, because you know they want A, B, or C, or D, or you know, and you get into it. So that's understood. But actually, the proper mood is that we should serve Krishna very nice things, and we just simply take the remnants of Krishna's table scraps. And we should not offer Krishna things with a view to enjoying them. And to me, you see, that brings about a change. One nice thing about prasadam, two things for me work very well for changing paradigms. Because when we look at the material world through the paradigm of mode of passion, then we are seeing all objects as actual or potential sense objects. I see a member of the opposite sex, I think of this member of the opposite sex as at least potentially enjoyable by me. And all men do this anyway, at least those ways in the West do that with women all the time. It's just, it's what, you know, they're sex objects, that's what they are. And even if I'm not, you know, if I'm happily married and not thinking of doing anything, still you look at members of the opposite sex in that way, as potentially enjoyable by me. We look at anything we see, and we accept and reject on the basis of my sense gratification. Well, is this person in a potential sexual partner or not? Is this person a potential business partner or not? What can I get out of it, or what can I not get out of it? And that's our consciousness. Now, when we engage in Krishna's service, of engaging things in Krishna's service, we start to bring about a change in the way we see objects. So I'm going to cook prasadam for Krishna. I'm going to cook for Krishna now. So I go to the supermarket, and now I see all the things sitting there, and I'm thinking, let me take these nice fruits and vegetables and prepare something nice for Krishna. So I'm starting to take the objects of the senses and change the way I see them. Another nice thing is when we used to go shopping for deity cloth. And you want to buy nice, beautiful things for decorating the deity. So now you look at it's costume jewelry and silks and things like that. Not as enjoyable by me, but as enjoyable by Krishna. You start to change the way you see things. Similarly, you go on book distribution of Sankirtan, you go up to people, and now you don't evaluate them as potentially enjoyable or not by me, but really what you're doing is potentially enjoyable by Krishna. If you want to take somebody and make them a devotee of Krishna, it means you're bringing them to Krishna, to serve Krishna, for Krishna to enjoy. So by this systematic activity, the whole world begins to change. And the mood of, by engaging things in Krishna service, the mood of being the enjoyer, or I can have the other attitude, of course, of renunciation, that here I am at the feast, but I'm not eating. That's very difficult too. So the enjoyment mood is I'm going to eat at the feast, and the renunciation mood is I'm at the feast and I'm not eating. But the real devotional mood is this whole feast is for Krishna. And that's what we have to do. So we have to engage in these practices. And Prabhupada, Narada Muni compares it to the homeopathic principle of medicine. The same thing which causes our disease, therapeutically treated, can cure it. So the same activities of the senses which formerly bound us to material nature now release us if those activities are directed toward Krishna service. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Hey, come on up.
It's a question on the big one. Namely, just sexual desire. You quoted a verse which I take it as from the Bhagavad Gita. Those who are wise take no delight in them.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Now, I do quite a lot of work in pastoral counselling as part of my activity in Australia. Now, from time to time, I deal with devotees who are distressed by one thing and another. Now, in this particular case, a devotee who was in his late 40s spent a week with me, and he was really very, very distressed by his sexual desires. And to be quite specific, of course not with his name, but to be quite specific, he would say, he said that he would go out distributing books or selling cloths, I think it was, shirts and things like that. And a beautiful lady would walk past. And he would become so frustrated because his awareness would immediately go to this very attractive sense object. And he felt that because this was happening practically all the time, that he was failing in his Krishna consciousness. And when he came to me, he was in quite a deep depression. It was quite serious. He was in quite a bad way. Couldn't sleep, even suicidal, actually, I can say. Suicidal. Now, he was desperate, really, on this matter. And in his case, as in my own, and in the case of other people, the advice that I offer is as follows, and I would like you to comment on it in light of what you've been saying. The advice that I give is that since our senses are made to engage, to recognize certain stimuli in the environment, in this case, a beautiful human being or an attractive human being, since our senses were designed by God to respond in a certain way, then what is the point of denying the attraction? What is the point of fighting the attraction if I'm designed to be attracted? But the next step is, as I suggested to him and as I suggest to other people, I hope I'm doing this legitimately in terms of Krishna consciousness, but the advice that I give is, okay, recognize the attraction, don't fight it, don't deny it, don't feel bad about it, accept that you are attracted to this beautiful object that God has made, but then consciously and deliberately say, I release you. I let you go. I just release you, I let you go. I have no intention to engage with you, either grossly or in the mind. But I recognize the beauty, I'm attracted to the beauty, I thank God for the beauty, but I say, not for me, I let you go.
Yeah. No comment on that. I think, first of all, the point about acknowledgement of the desire is an important one. Because, and also acknowledge that, you know, she's beautiful. I mean, there's no sense in denying that fact. And that I'm attracted. It's very bad to have desires that I can neither control nor acknowledge. That really creates havoc. So the best thing is to acknowledge those desires. And then you're right not to get depressed about it, but just say, okay, this is my, I want to become free from these. The real thing, what is good in Krishna consciousness? What we consider is good. It's not that I'm on this platform or this platform or this platform or this platform, but whatever platform I'm on, I'm getting better. And anyone who's getting better or is in the progressive path of improving is good. So that I may be endowed with a super dose of the mode of passion. I come into the world and that's the deck I'm playing with, and it was maybe my past sinful activities, but that's what I have to deal with. And what I have to do is understand I have to become free from this in order to make spiritual advancement, and I have to get myself on a program by which I can become free from it. So there has to be a certain amount of acknowledgement of this desire. The I release it is very good, but I'll tell you an experience I had that was very enlightening for me. Just listening to a tape, Prabhupada was in a discussion with an Indian gentleman, and this was like a big turning point in my understanding of the nature of things. And this Indian gentleman was a Christian, and apparently from Kerala, where there's a lot of Christians, and he had been made a Christian like many people are by hearing Krishna blaspheme. And specifically, his activities with the gopis were thought to be degraded. So he said to Prabhupada, how can you worship a god who is an adulterer? And Prabhupada said, Krishna is not an adulterer. You are the adulterer. All women belong to Krishna. And man, I felt this pang in my heart like a spear, And I realized I was envious of Krishna because I thought, when the living entity puts himself up to be a competitor with God, well, what it really means that Krishna is an enjoyer is precisely that. All women belong to Krishna. I should say here, of course this is from the male point of view, Prabhupada did say in one lecture, for the man, woman is the woman, but for the woman, man is the woman. So whoever's the sex object, that belongs to Krishna. So he said that all women belong to Krishna. So to see a beautiful member of the opposite sex, attractive member of the opposite sex, you have to say this is enjoyable by Krishna, not by me. I'm not Krishna's competitor. In one point, a number of years ago, in the olden days, the present Pope made a remark that a man should not look lustfully even upon his own wife, and he had to back down. There was such an uproar. But it's really true. One has to at least come to that position. If you've been married for 30 years, it's easier. She's a grandmother anyway, but anyway, this is what we have to come to that position. All women belong to Krishna. So not just give it up, but say, it's not that I release the objects to, the vague nothing, but to me they're Krishna's. Everything is enjoyable by Krishna. And I'm not going to poach on his territory. That's what's put me in the material world. Okay. Do you have a statement, question? Come on up.
I have a few minutes. I know. Of course, it is obvious for all that Ravindra Swarup is one of the true thinkers of Iskcon today, carrying on the great tradition from Lakshmi Thakur and Jiva Goswami. But yes, and not that I'm going to criticize you now. I just want to make sure that I got quite clear how this today's theme of the existential conditions connects with or relate to the themes you brought up yesterday and the day before yesterday about the two colliding paradigms of pratyaksha and shabda, of empiricism, of only acknowledging the knowledge you get through the senses, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the paradigm which only recognizes the knowledge you get through revelation and hearing from authority. You said in the first part of your series of lectures here that there was a leap of faith in both these cases, not only for those who accept Shraddha, but also for those who accept pratyaksha or empiricism as the only valid knowledge. I think that is true, but since you now brought up the concept of Vaidusha Pratyaksha, which I think is a key concept really, I would like to ask you, doesn't that mean that, I mean, given that the existential conditions are, or requirements are fulfilled, and there exists such a thing as Vaidusha Pratyaksha, doesn't that mean that there is a leap of faith only to the degree that those conditions are not fulfilled?
Yeah, sure.
I mean,
I mean to say that you begin with the leap of faith. You put your, but you can't, the knowledge, whatever it is, develops after a process. So to begin with the process, you commit yourself to the process without having. What you have faith in is whoever these Vaidushas are, which is not me.
No, then definitely not me, of course, either.
Yeah, it's not me.
The interesting thing is that if there exists such a thing as Vaidusha Pratyaksha, and of course, rather that you possess this faculty or qualification, in that case, there is no longer a leap of faith. It is realized knowledge. It is vijnana.
That is true.
But then again, we don't. Even then, we should not, I believe, play down faith or the role of faith, because faith also has other meanings than simply theoretically holding true a vision or thesis or statements about reality, which you don't really, which haven't yet realized. There's also the sense of trust or yes, exactly, and
love,
yes, and confidence, and, yes.
Yeah, that's the full flowering of faith, and I think you're right.
Right. Thank you.
You want to say something? I guess this has to be the last one that we have to put. Go ahead.
It's just a technical point about this question of faith that Madhvacharya gives a very good point on this, and it's in regard to the points that you were discussing of you begin with faith and then you go into association and then you go into regulative principles and then you go into the practice of anatta nivritti and so on all the way to prema, and we have this course from Shraddha to prema. But Madhva points out, first there's Shraddha, then there's association, then there's Shraddha. Because through each step of development of the process, the faith is increasing to take you to the next step.
Yeah.
So you, in between, it's like the mortar that holds the bricks together as you build the house. So it's not just there's faith and then you go on.
It's not that the faith stops either.
No.
It's like we discussed yesterday about the stages. The stages continue. So that your advancement, actually one way of advancement is the quality of your faith, whether it's soft or medium or very strong. So the Uttama Adhikari, his faith is
unflinching.
Unflinching. Unflinching. I forgot the Sanskrit. It's unflinching faith. Never can be deviated under any circumstances whatsoever. And of course it's so strong because it's based on direct knowledge, has been confirmed. In the beginning it's tentative and weak and doubtful, and then it gets stronger. So yeah, you're right, it continues and grows on and develops and becomes, at first it may be, you know, a belief in things unseen. But then those things become seen. But that belief, then it's fidelity, it's trust, it's commitment, it's love. It's not just faith, but it's faithfulness. There's different dimensions and so on. Yeah. Okay, we better stop now. Thank you very much. I'll go ahead and sit up. Sometimes people think like classical music is an mode of goodness, you know. No, maybe Bach, but not Wagner, you know. So, you know, See, if you look at some of the stuff, it's very passionate. You know, Beethoven, the whole thing is, you know, big longing for absolute and striving for something higher, you know? But you never get there. Only I think in Bach you get to know the goodness, you know? And only that one is like a church music, you know, kind of talk. Another one, I don't think it's there.
What about ethics and morals?
Yeah. You'll have to think about it. So again, you know, people with a mode of passion, they. When you think of moral philosophers, not like Thomas Hobbes. Here's an example. He talks about ethics and morals, but he derives it not from God's injunction, but from the fact that people are together. They're in a state of nature. It's the war of all against the all. So they get one person to be the king, and he makes among the people in the king, there's kind of a state of warfare. But among the people now, because there's a king, they're peaceful among each other. You know, so this way he deduces like all kinds of morals and political principles. But just based on some kind of theory of regulation of conflict, and yeah. So they start out that we can gratify our senses more if we cooperate and if we fight with each other. And so therefore, there's, you know, there's sort of a contractual theory of morality.
Like if it's honest and moral,
yeah.
First,
and make more money, the better, yeah. And life will actually be better for sense gratification than if everybody's something cheap. Well, I think something like that, because you do get more in religious, even religious principles. Yeah, but they said there's only a glimpse. And you don't ever see that much. I have to look at that passage again.
The
what?
Five is better than the
road. Yeah, okay. I'll look at that. Okay.